I'm not sure that I got the sort of general focus of the meeting straight, but that's what I'm going to do. And hopefully, by discussing several aspects of our bacterial physiology over the past 30 years, we'll find some areas in which physicists might be interested. So my long-term interest has been in the physiology of the enteric bacteria, E. coli and Salmonella typhimurium, which are inhabitants of the intestine of man and other warm-blooded animals. The fact that enteric bacteria have been so well studied makes them organisms of choice for determining principles on which cells are self-replicating entities. That's been clear to me for some time. The main interest in my lab has been in nitrogen metabolism of these organisms because it has several simplifying features that make it more tractable than other aspects of metabolism. And one of those features is that there are only two central intermediates in nitrogen metabolism. They're the amino acids glutamate and glutamine. By contrast to that, an organism has to generate 12 intermediates from any carbon compound, and that's too many to measure comfortably. There's only a single precursor for nitrogen-containing compounds, 2-oxoglutarate, which is made by a cycle of reactions called the tricarboxylic acid cycle. Enteric bacteria do not excrete or lose any glutamate or glutamine to their growth medium. And for that reason, we've been able to measure the free concentrations of these amino acids in cells, which are called free pool concentrations, by placing the cells directly into methanol. At that point, the free amino acids are released. We refer to that procedure as a no-harvest protocol because we don't have to separate the cells from their growth medium. And we know that if you try to do that, you run into problems. Unfortunately, we can't use a no-harvest protocol for 2-oxoglutarate because significant amounts of it are excreted. Conveniently, enteric bacteria use glutamate and glutamine for two different purposes. The free pool concentration of glutamine changes over more than a tenfold range depending on the availability of nitrogen. A drop in that pool concentration of that magnitude appears to be the means by which enteric bacteria sense or detect that they're externally nitrogen limited. The glutamate concentration doesn't change under those circumstances. And that's a summary of at least 5 years of experiments. That observation is very robust. By contrast, glutamate, a negative ion, is required to maintain the steady state pool concentration of the ion potassium, and I'll return to that. Go on, thank you. To explore the reason why enteric bacteria might use glutamine rather than glutamate to sense nitrogen availability, Ned Wingreen and I have analyzed the nitrogen transfers that occur from these two compounds. Ned, of course, is here. And I'm going to quote on this slide from a recent summary that Ned formulated. So in his view, the use of glutamine to sense nitrogen limitation prevents internal stresses. And some of our observations are summarized here. The amide group of glutamine is required directly for the biosynthesis of monomeric units of all macromolecules, proteins, nucleic acids, and surface polymers. Consequently, depletion of the free pool of glutamine under nitrogen-limiting conditions simultaneously slows fluxes into a number of biosynthetic pathways. With the exception of the histidine biosynthetic pathway, glutamine is required at the first dedicated step of every pathway in which it's utilized. By contrast, glutamate is more often than not required at the final step or in the middle of a pathway. With this organization of pathways, nitrogen limitation does not result in the accumulation of useless and/or toxic intermediates. In the histidine pathway, such accumulations are avoided by the extremely high affinity of the glutamine-requiring enzyme for glutamine. Glutamine-dependent reactions are generally coupled to hydrolysis of ATP, and so they cannot reverse to refill a depleted glutamine pool.
Extremely high affinity is how high?
With respect to the pool concentration inside the cell, I believe it's some tenfold better than what's available. Yeah? But I would have to go back and look at the detail of that. Yeah? So it turns out that in Ned's view, because you don't get this reversal, you can maintain high pools of glutamine-dependent products, thus preventing product starvation responses. Ned and I are agreed on the first two points, but not yet on the implications of the third. He thinks that pools of glutamine-derived end products, as I said, can be maintained under nitrogen-limiting conditions and are, in fact, maintained. It's clear that if you can do that, presumably by slowing the utilization of these products more than their synthesis, that that would have regulatory advantages, and I can go back to those if you wish. I think that decreased fluxes into the pools of these products should result in decreases in pool concentrations. Clearly, the way to resolve the difference is to make measurements of the relevant pool concentrations, and it turns out that that remains non-trivial. However, it's clear that the next step has to happen in the experimental arena. Ned concludes by noting that it's in some sense miraculous that cells can continue to grow at rates varying by more than a factor of 100, I would say by a factor of at least 20, without succumbing to internal stresses. And we're working to understand the principles of network organization that give metabolism this sort of versatility. So as I told you, glutamate, the other intermediate in nitrogen metabolism, is required to maintain the steady state pool of potassium ions. And hence, no, I'm not going to describe it. So there are two ways to make glutamate, one directly from ammonia and 2-oxoglutarate in a single enzymatic reaction that doesn't work very well at low ammonia concentrations. And the second in a cycle of two enzymes where if you use the low affinity pathway, you need two enzymes to make glutamine. If you use the high affinity pathway, you assimilate it in a single reaction that's then coupled to another that's making glutamate. You have basically one or two enzymes involved in that. And it's the fact, the glutamine synthetase enzyme allows the high affinity pathway for ammonia assimilation generally to work because it couples ATP to the reaction and drives it in the forward direction even when ammonia concentrations go down very low. So you can drive that by a million fold using ATP hydrolysis if you have no problem with energy. Okay, I might as well shift so that we are moving on to glutamate. I told you so, it's required to maintain the steady state potassium pool, and so it's central not only to nitrogen metabolism, but to osmoregulation. It's known that cells increase their internal concentrations of potassium and glutamate when the concentration of external osmolytes, salts, or sugars is increased. That's true for all bacteria and archaea that have been examined in this regard. That's the first line of defense to prevent them from losing water. We know that mutant strains that lack a normal glutamate pool cannot maintain their steady state potassium pool. They leak it, and they grow very poorly, but we don't know why. So although glutamate and potassium are known to play important roles in the biochemistry of the cell interior, these roles are little explored. And likewise, nothing is known about how the glutamate pool concentration is regulated in response to external osmolytes. So here I just list some of the problems that may occur when potassium glutamate pools are depleted. That could cause a loss of polyribosomes and defects in translation of mRNA into protein. It's known that polysome organization is exquisitely sensitive to salt concentration in vitro. There could be defects in cell wall synthesis. Apparently, TERGR, positive internal osmotic pressure, is required for expansion of the murine or semi-rigid layer of the cell envelope. And finally, there could be problems due to tight protein-nucleic acid interactions. These interactions certainly become stronger at low salt in vitro. Whether that's the case in vivo, and if so, what problems it might cause are unexplored. So at this time, the bases for slow growth in cells with low potassium glutamate pools are not known. It could be one or more of these factors or factors that we're not aware of. So we've recently begun to use DNA microarrays to explore the consequences of nitrogen limitation in E. coli, and we're beginning to use them to explore the consequences of potassium glutamate limitation. Can we get any hints from what the cells transcribe or don't transcribe under these circumstances as to what the problems are or what the mechanisms are for coordinating slowing of growth under nitrogen-limiting conditions, for example? For the most part, we work with microarrays that we've printed on glass slides, and although this is probably unnecessary, I'll divert briefly and review the principles of the experiments. So you start by synthesizing all the genes of the organism that you're exploring using the polymerase chain reaction and printing those genes robotically on glass slides. We worked with the labs of Carol Gross and Nick Cazzarelli to do that for the 4,400 gene products of E. coli. You then grow two cultures of your organism. It can be a given strain under two different conditions, or two different strains under the same conditions, and you isolate RNA from the cultures. And then in essence, you color the RNA with different colored fluorescent labels. You can use a red fluorescent dye and a green fluorescent dye, actually when you're making complementary DNA. And this is a little bit misleading because you then take these two preps of complementary DNA, mix them first, and then hybridize them to the glass slide, so that if you have equal amounts of messenger RNA for a given gene, you get a yellow spot and otherwise a red or a green spot. So what I'd like to do is show you how we handle microarray data for E. coli, our primary tool. So you're familiar with the fact that you get on the glass slides these mixtures of red, green, and yellow spots. And the most important tool that we have used in looking at microarray data is one that we call genome images. So Dan Zimmer, when he was a postdoc in my lab, wrote a computer program that rearranges the spots from the glass slides in their order of occurrence on the genome of E. coli. This slide isn't very well labeled, but some of the others will be. So in the top row, you're looking at raw data for the genes from 0 to 100, then 100 to 200, and so forth, all the way down to the end. And of course, the genome is circular, so the end connects back to the beginning, in fact, in the organism. The blank spots represent B numbers that were assigned, and then there was no product, or things that are, for some reason, missing for trivial reasons. So this is very useful because, in fact, genes whose products work together are often adjacent to one another on bacterial or archaeal genomes or the genomes of their viruses. And in this particular experiment, we've taken a strain and then taken the same strain and induced expression of the lactose degradative enzymes. And what you see here is a row of spots that are red. Okay, we colored red after we induced. That's the lactose degradative operon. And in fact, the fourth spot happens to be an extension of the transcript. The transcript is started from a given place, goes through those genes, and then there is an operon facing it in the opposite direction, and there's a little bit of antisense RNA for the first gene in that adjacent operon. So it turns out that transcripts are not terminated precisely. They're allowed to run on in many instances and then processed back as the protein products are translated. So I'm going to show you another example and then get back to nitrogen metabolism. This happens to be a genome image of two strains grown in the same enriched medium. One of them is motile and one of them is poorly motile. For the motile strain, we also induced the lac operon so that we would see at least one difference between the two strains. These strings of red spots that you see are operons for flagella, the organs of
motile. Red is associated with a substantial difference between the two?
Either red or green. And it depends on which way you use your labels. In this experiment, there isn't a great deal of green, and in many of the experiments I'm going to show you, there isn't a great deal of green. And I've just used the red because it highlights what I want you to see. So the things that are red here, okay, are things that you see expressed in the motile strain and not the poorly motile strain. And in essence, all the long strings you see are involved either in synthesis of flagella, the organs of motility, or in making a response to chemical signals, the chemotactic response. So the point is that this is a very striking visual way for a biologist to look at microarray data from these organisms. Modal means it can move and make responses to chemical signals. Yeah. Okay. So I want to say in passing that genes and operons must be their own closest neighbors in terms of expression changes because they're transcribed together. However, they often do not occur as closest neighbors when microarray data are analyzed using standard clustering algorithms. If you're interested, I can tell you some of the reasons for that. For now, I'd just like to make the point that genome images are a valuable complement to various forms of cluster analysis, as I said, for bacterial and archaeobiologists and those interested in their viruses, because all of these organisms or entities have operons. So I'm going to turn back to nitrogen metabolism.
Are the bright yellow spots something like ribosomal?
Yes, those are these are ribosomal proteins. Yeah, and in many instances, the bright yellow spots are in fact reflective of high levels of gene expression for whatever reasons.
Can you tell what percentage of the genes are on under this condition?
No, I'm going to come back to that in connection with Affymetrix arrays.
Okay.
I mean, people try. I haven't. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Maybe you should tell us why clustering is not good and doesn't show the
evidence. I'm not saying it's not good. Let me give you an example that's illustrative of problems. And I think, in fact, at some point, this is a very complicated matter. One could write algorithms that took operon organization into account. And then your problem is going to be that, as you've already heard from Jim, you can get operons within operons, operons that move about depending on the circumstances and the regulations. So that's going to be a non-trivial exercise. Let me go forward and then come back to your question, because I can get it when I show you the next. Remind me, please. So now we wanted to go back to nitrogen metabolism and first study the homeostatic response of E. coli to nitrogen limitation. So that's the response it makes as the internal pool concentration of glutamine starts to drop, and it makes that response to try to avoid slowing its growth. The response is made under control of a transcriptional activator protein called nitrogen regulatory protein C or NTRC. So to determine the homeostatic response, we could use mutant strains. And we use one mutant strain that overproduces everything under NTRC control, and one mutant strain that can't produce anything under NTRC control because NTRC is disrupted. Then you can compare the patterns of gene expression in those two strains with excess nitrogen. You don't have to complicate your life by slowing growth. And this is simply a genome image of that comparison. And all I want you to see here is, again, strings of genes that are red. Okay, and I'm going to tell you more about those in just a minute.
This is one strain with
One strain with overexpressed NTRC, one strain that's an NTRC null.
And is that because the signal to noise is too low to compare either of those strains individually to wild type?
You can do it, but your signal is muted. And the point on glass slide microarrays is your signal is always, if anything, muted with respect to what you would measure in other ways, for example, by using gene fusions or making direct measurements. That's correct. Yes, and that's a wonderful question because people thought I'd lost my mind because I refused to move along with microarrays until I solved the problem of induction of the lac operon. When we started, the actual inductions we were getting with IPTG were 900 to 1,000 fold, and what we were seeing on microarrays was threefold. We had to work very hard to get 30-fold changes on microarrays that corresponded to 900-fold changes in reality. There is an order of magnitude difference, particularly in cases where baseline expression is very low and you have problems with background subtraction.
Protein.
And for based on everything we know, reflected directly at the mRNA level. Those experiments have been done. Well, basically, we improved our technique in various ways, but the most important of them was simply printing enough of the gene product on the slide to get better hybridization. It's a two-body problem, and we had to increase the amount of the gene on the slide.
So it's really, at the mRNA level, it's known that it's 900-fold.
Yes.
And the best that can come out of the chips is...
Glass slide microarrays in my hands 30-fold. That's the best I see. Sometimes a little bit more, but I would say that, you know, a good 10-fold below what is really happening. And I realize that, and I take that into account when I design experiments, and that's why this experiment was designed this way.
And is it understood why that was a big discrepancy?
I don't think all the reasons for that are understood, and let me just say at this point that affymetrix arrays do better. Their range is much greater than glass slides, and so I might as well say at this point that we've used the antisense affymetrix arrays for E. coli. They seem to work very well.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I don't remember that number. I suspect we've done that experiment, and I don't remember that number. That's a good question, Richard.
And does it scale? So if you had used a lower level of inducer, so you said a tenfold change.
We tried. You don't get good intermediate levels of induction of the lac operon, as it turns out. It goes on or off. You know, the complexity is better than I. Let me tell you that in some instances, if your baseline expression is high, robust, and you go up tenfold, you can pick up that tenfold directly on microarrays.
As
a tenfold change. So it's you either match what you see or you're muted. You're never in excess on a glass slide microarray, in my experience, which is fairly, you know, extensive at this point. So I want to show you just one more thing about what you can do with these. So in this case, we take that same pair of mutant strains and we grow them either on ammonia or we grow them on glutamine as the nitrogen source. And we make the genome images and line them up. So this is two aligned genome images. The top row, you're going from genes 1 to 100 and so forth. And now the decades are marked along the top. And all I want you to see here is how good the alignment is. of these red spots, okay? And let me just add in passing here that in this particular synthesis of PCR products, this is an operon, this is a bad PCR product. So some of the advantages of genome images are they show you all your sins. This is your raw data. You can tell when you have a good experiment, when you have a bad experiment, when you have problems with particular batches of PCR products. I think it's a wonderful, wonderfully useful tool.
What are you comparing?
I'm comparing NTRC con to NTRC minus with the pair of strains grown either on ammonia or glutamine as the nitrogen source, so they're growing very fast. I don't have to complicate my life with slow growth, okay?
Yeah.
And I'm just getting the homeostatic response by asking which genes are under control of the transcriptional regulator that brings about the homeostatic response. And I'm going to tell you about those genes in a minute. Yes. Yes. I don't remember, and in fact, they're down here somewhere, and in fact, it's difficult to see the response for glutamine synthetase because the baseline expression of that gene is quite high, and it looks yellow here. Okay? You see the red tinge, but it looks yellow, and of course, you do the numbers in addition. They're down here at the bottom somewhere. I want to say right in here, but that could be wrong. Okay, I haven't thought about this in a while. So when you take those and you make a list, what's the homeostatic response? Well, it turns out the homeostatic response is transport. These cells turn on 25 operons for transport of essentially everything that might be in their environment that contains a nitrogen atom. Purines, pyrimidines, amino acids, polyamines, peptides, you name it, they turn it on. And so the take-home message from this is the response, the homeostatic response to nitrogen limitation is a scavenging response. And that happens in spite of the fact that we have not added any of those compounds to the medium. So it's clear the organism organizes itself to look for them. Now let's come back to the question of clustering algorithms. It turns out that a number of these operons are so-called ABC transport operons. They're multi-component. They have components that are in the periplasmic space that bind the substrate. They have components that are in the membrane, and they have components that are on the cytoplasmic side of the membrane that couple ATP to transport of those substances. So it turns out that those transcripts are made. They are immediately processed into different pieces. Each piece gives rise to a different amount of product and has a different half-life. And it turns out that if you use clustering algorithms now, all the periplasmic components will cluster with one another to the exclusion of the other members of their operon and likewise for the other types of components. And of course, that gives you one kind of information, but it doesn't give me as a physiologist the information I most want. Okay, so all of these things are complicated and you answer the question you ask.
But they will also show up
in different colors on your genome. That's exactly right. So what I'm compensating for when I look at my genome image, okay, and then look at the numbers that correspond, it turns out that I am able to see my response correspond to the boundaries of an operon, despite the fact that the effects on individual genes are not quantitatively the same.
If I may push that a little further.
Please. Well, we've never tried to force that. Yeah, I don't know enough about the mathematics to modify standard clustering algorithms. And I do know enough to know that I cannot go to a mathematician and say, okay, these are the borders of the operons and they're always fixed. Because that's not the case. If I could do that, I would go right away to a mathematician and get the clustering algorithm modified. For my purposes. It's more complicated than that. Yeah. Yes.
I guess a related question to that point. You mentioned with lack that you saw a read-through, you've actually mentioned. Here's how often you seem to see that.
We see that occasionally, but the point is that if you're aware of it, you're aware of it. So, you know, that antisense, of course, can confuse you because that looks like that gene is being expressed and you have to know that it isn't.
Well, I guess I was wondering if you ever had any examples where you suspect it actually is using antisense to downregulate.
I have no examples where I have any reason to believe that is the case, but of course there are going to be such examples, yes. Yes. No, these are under control, in essence, of a single transcription factor.
I understand. Are there other transcription factors?
Yes, there's one other, and I'm going to show you something interesting about that. Just a minute. There's one other transcription factor. Well, there are a couple of other transcription factors. They are regulators. Yeah? Once more?
There is not enough nitrogen.
Yes. That's a different question. So could some of these genes also be regulated in response to carbon availability? Of course. Are there some mistakes in here? Indirect effects? Yes. You're going to spot OMPF. Okay. This the expression of OMPF varies every time we do anything to the culture. We have no reason to think that that's a direct effect. And I am sure that this table is polluted. And so when we published on this table, we were very careful to specify with question marks and appropriate statements our concern about how this table might be polluted. We don't know the bases for pollution of our direct effects with indirect effects.
Are these arranged from strongest to weakest?
No, they are not. These are in order. These are in genome order.
They're in genome.
Yes, and on our website, all the numbers are up. They're readily accessible.
The fold reduction.
Yes. Okay. So returning to the matter of other transcription factors or regulatory proteins, GLIN-K is a regulatory protein, and I'm going to come back to AMTB. NAC is a regulatory protein. This is an interesting regulatory protein, CBL. It's ostensibly for sulfur metabolism, and it is induced by itself under sulfur-limiting conditions and is probably induced jointly with NAC under nitrogen-limiting conditions, and we can't find any real reason for that yet, all right? But I'll tell you something about NAC. So that's what I'm going to tell you next. All right, so NTRC, nitrogen regulatory protein C, works with a special form of RNA polymerase that has an alternative sigma factor called sigma 54. NAC is the nitrogen assimilation control protein. It works with polymerase carrying the major, most abundant sigma factor, sigma 70. So what happens is there's a regulatory cascade. NTRC induces the synthesis of NAC, and then NAC induces the synthesis of things under its control. And it turns out that you can do a set of experiments with a set of mutants grown under different conditions, and I'm showing you here snippets of genome images now from 11 different experiments for a single operon to make a point. In this case, you can tell from the pattern of red, these are flanking genes, so you break the pattern for this operon. You can tell from the pattern of red in the different experiments that this operon is directly under NTRC control, and you can tell from the different pattern of red, okay, in these experiments that it's the same experiments. For this operon, you can tell from the different pattern of red that this is under NAC control. So you can sort out who in the cascade is the direct activator of any one of these transport systems. You see that by making different comparisons of different mutant strains. So we can inactivate NAC, or inactivate NTRC, or inactivate both. So this is just a set of experiments designed to discriminate between those two things.
But the pattern of red, it's not this fact that the beginning and the end of the operon are brighter on the right.
No. No, that's an artifact. That's an artifact.
For human studies, we understand correctly that genes from 1483 up to 1488 are all expressed under the same signal to non-conformal?
That's correct, and...
And what about the gaps that the areas in this CNPR are not signal?
These gaps?
Yes.
Okay, this is something that I pointed out to you earlier. This was a particular synthesis of PCR products. This was a bad product. These four experiments were done with the next synthesis of PCR products, and we got it right. Okay? I see all of that, you see, and as a biologist, I look for that because that matters to me. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that's a real interesting operon. Nothing was known about that. That has to do with murine synthesis, and it has to do with a scavenging response in which the cell tries to recover part of the materials that it uses to make the cell wall. And as it's doing that, it's actually modifying the structure of the murine layer in a way that is believed to make the cell more resistant to a variety of different sorts of insult. So that turned out to be a very interesting observation that came out of the arrays. Yes?
Do you think that there's anything, I mean, you could do this experiment if you knew about NAC already?
That's correct.
Is there any kind of approach that you can use that would let you pick up indirect effects that are resulting, I mean, that would let you say, aha, this might be an indirect effect?
I don't think there are any general aha mechanisms. I think there's just the toolbox we always use. So if you see, suppose you didn't know about NAC, if you see NTRC turning on something that you then go to look at as in terms of protein and see it's a DNA binding protein, of course that's the smoking gun. And then beyond that, you're just using everything in your arsenal. And basically, I realized that it would take me 20 years to get the pollution out of that table, and that what I should do is just publish it with the caveats and move along, because the pollution was going to get sorted out in other ways. Yeah?
So
Well, it turns out that I forget the detail here. This was I believe that these are NTRC minus strains compared to themselves under different growth conditions. And basically, they're not able to express those operons. Yeah. So it's lots of different comparisons, that all of which taken together tell you that you're pretty sure. And what would happen is, you know, things that I marked NTRC in the table we published look like this, and things that I marked NAC look like that. And then the question marks tell you, oh boy, you know, you could get a headache. You immediately got a headache, and every time you did it, no matter how you did it, with how many experiments, you always get a headache. Okay. All right. Okay, so now I'm going to get into really things that are new and not very well digested, but I thought I should mention them here because maybe Jim will shoot them down and I'll be safe in terms of publishing something that's very wrong. All right, so let me tell you before I turn to this that we did go back to the matter of nitrogen limitation with a wild type strain. Now we can subtract out the homeostatic response. So we can take a wild type strain and let it grow slowly under a nitrogen limiting condition and ask whether we are able to learn anything about how the cell coordinates the slowing of growth under those circumstances. And I'm going to summarize that by saying it's been very difficult to learn anything interesting in that regard. We've learned a few little things, I'm very pleased, fairly recently, but I would say that the cells tend to conceal how they've gone from one circumstance to another. You can learn more by doing abrupt transitions from one circumstance to another before they've had a chance to conceal quite so much. But we're not making great progress with that, and so I think microarrays are of limited usefulness for asking the questions to which I would most like to have the answers. But it's clear that they will give you the members of any regulon you wish if you do the experiments carefully and thoughtfully. Told you about the affymetrix arrays, and I will tell you one last thing, that for nitrogen limitation, it's clear that we've done all our experiments in batch cultures. We need to do some of those experiments, as many as possible, in continuous culture where you can control the growth rate of the culture, fix it and keep it at whatever growth rate you wish for as long as you wish. So the continuous culture experiments are also in the works. So the other thing we've added to this is we've been working with Professor Don Hunt at the University of Virginia, who's a superb mass spectroscopist, to try to get a protein profile of E. coli. So he uses high-pressure liquid chromatography followed by tandem mass spectrometry. And we started looking for a protein profile for E. coli cells grown on minimal medium with glycerol as the carbon source and ammonium as the nitrogen source. That's a standard nitrogen excess condition for us. With very small amounts of material, the equivalent of 10 to the 8th cells, and short run times of about 4 hours, we identified 1,150 proteins, a quarter of those in the organism. We calculate that we detect reliably all proteins present in greater than or equal to 100 copies per cell, and we are detecting many expressed at lower levels. So what I'm showing you on this slide is the relationship between the percent of proteins in two different protein lists that I'll tell you about in just a minute, and the signals that we see when we do affymetrix arrays under the same conditions. So let me tell you about the protein lists first, and then I'll tell you about the affymetrix arrays. Yes. A quarter of all the proteins there are seem to be expressed under these conditions. That's not the point. The point is I detect with a certain degree of reliability at least a quarter of the proteins in the entire genome. So old estimates of the number of genes that would be expressed at the protein level under a given condition are approximately 25%. Now the estimates are rising, but I don't want a list that's heavily polluted with false positives. And so I've insisted that the criteria be kept very high.
I just want to think about 100 proteins. So, if the proteins are long-lived, then the...
Most proteins in this organism are long-lived.
So then how are you getting the number of proteins?
I'm giving you an estimate based on Don's detection limit. He thinks he can pick up 10 femtomoles. That would require that with the number of cells he's using, 10 to the 8th per experiment, that I have to have at least 100 copies per cell for him to be reasonably sure that he'll pick it up. This is just, you know, we're getting started here. I'm coming. Give me a chance to go through it, and then you can hit me on all the things that aren't right or aren't clear. So let me tell you about the list first, and then I'll tell you about the numbers, okay? Because they tell me something that nobody believes, okay? And I'm worried about it. The short list is a list of 404 proteins that he gave us first, for which they detect, they use the Sequest algorithm, so the entire analysis is automated. For these, they detect at least 4 independent tryptic peptides per protein. That's the gold list, okay? That was the gold list we started with. The second list is a list of 1,150 proteins, 1,147, that has two parts. That list was a list of proteins for at least one tryptic peptide was identified by that algorithm with a high reliability score. And it consists of 900 or almost 1,000 proteins from the same soluble extract he used to get the 404 list. And then about 150 proteins from a sample that we enriched in membranes, because it is very clear that detection of membrane proteins remains an enormous problem. So those are the protein lists. Then what we did in this slide, and I'll show you in the next one, you can do it differently, is we simply took all 4,300 protein encoding genes and we binned them, okay, in groups of, we had 10 groups, so 430 in each group. And we binned them based on mRNA signal intensity on affymetrix arrays. So they're going from highest to lowest. And this shows you the range of signal intensities for the top 10%. Okay, it's very large. All right, it also shows you the overall range of signal intensity on an affymetrix array, which is approximately 10 to the 5th. So what I want you to see here is that there seems to be a positive relationship between protein detection and signal intensity on these arrays, and that relationship is stronger for the short list than for the total list. Okay, we can do that differently. I can first analyze the Affymetrix data with their standard statistical algorithm, MOS 5.0. They use that with default parameters, we haven't fooled with them, to determine which of the genes they would consider are expressed. Those are their so-called present calls. And with that algorithm, they decide that 2,800 genes are being expressed. And what we do here is we simply plot our protein data. We take those 2,800 genes now and bin them so that each group has 280. And of course, the relationship is not as profound, but it's still there. You're losing the genes at the bottom of the signal intensity range. Let's see what I have next. That's different. I'll go back to that. So, okay.
But it still says that even the highest expressed ones, you get about half of the, in the mass spec, right? Because if you go back one slide, in the N01, we saw the guys with the mRNA highest overexpressed.
Yep.
Like you get about 40-50%.
No, 40% of the proteins we detect are in that bin. I'm not showing you the percentage of the proteins in that bin that we detect. Yeah, I'm not doing it the way you're saying it. I'm telling you of those proteins we detect, 404-1150, how many fall in that range of signal intensities?
Oh, so the sum of these numbers is 100%?
That's correct. That's correct, and it may be that I should be doing what you're saying in addition. Okay, I have not done that. I have done other forms of analyses in terms of what we're missing, all right? If you make the simple assumption, okay, but based on the way the mass spec analysis is done, the expectation is that you would pick up the most abundant proteins with the smallest samples and the shortest runs. And Affymetrix has gone to some trouble to say, oh yes, mRNA signal intensity is probably related to mRNA abundance. So the take-home message from this is protein abundance is related to mRNA abundance. And nobody really has thought about that being the case. So you could make a trivial explanation for that and say, okay, if every transcript is translated with equal frequency, the most abundant transcripts will give you the most abundant protein products. But there are many reasons to think that's not the case. You could turn the problem of explanation around and say, okay, if a particular transcript is frequently translated, it'll be protected from messenger RNA decay, and perhaps will remain more abundant than it might otherwise. The point is that at this point, these are new observations for us. First, we want to think about ways of verifying that the observations are correct. And I have one other line of evidence that I won't discuss right now. If the observations are correct, of course, we'll be interested in trying to explain them, seeing which of those two extreme explanations or which combination of others might provide explanation. So it strikes me that this is a project that might interest physicists interested in control of gene expression in regulatory networks, which is why I went ahead and talked about it, even though we're not ready. Yes. You have to yell at me because otherwise I won't hear you.
Some years ago, Fuchsia had a paper saying relating one mRNA transcript to every 4,000 proteins. Is your data in a ballpark with that?
I don't know that work well enough to comment on that. There are a variety of papers that have claimed that such a relationship does not exist between protein abundance and mRNA abundance. And there are many papers now that tell you that in fact you don't have these biases in the mass spectrometry, but we have them at the moment as far as I can tell. Yeah.
So what would you have expected this graph?
You would expect that if in fact you have different different strengths of translational start or other forms of translational regulation, that you might not have this relationship.
No.
Between the decline as a function of signal intensity. Yeah, which is simply, you know, I'm on the wrong one. Let me cover this and then we can go back. It turns out that if you take the 270 proteins that have been identified by a variety of people on two-dimensional gels, and you do the same sort of plot, you see the same sort of relationship as if they're picking up abundant proteins coming from abundant transcripts. And if you take a look, as it turns out, at the minimal gene set required for life, which I was harassing Jim about earlier, first formulated by Mushagian and Kunin from mycoplasmas, it too is about 250 genes. Interesting. Same sort of pattern. Now, I'm worried about being in a trap where things, other subtle things are just getting covered up, and you'd expect them to be covered up, and you'd expect to see exactly this. But we didn't originally expect to see exactly this. Yes?
If you look at the subset of proteins that are regulated at translational level, like ribosomal proteins, for example, and just look at that subset, does it show anything similar to this?
Well, the ribosomals, we pick up something like 50 out of the 55 ribosomal proteins because they're in the highest bin. So the point is that at the moment we don't have quantitation on the proteins, and Affymetrix, of course, has an attempt at quantitation on the transcripts. We don't have quantitation on the proteins, and we really don't have any new experiments designed to get at this. The other thing that I've done that's perhaps worth saying in passing, I want to save a little bit more time for one last thing. I'll skip one thing and come to one last thing. We took the proteins in each case that Don gave us and expanded them to operons. Okay, so because, you know, things in operons are coordinately expressed. And we said, okay, if we expand to operons, what are we missing? And for his 1150 list, we're missing about, I think, 300 or 400 proteins in those operons. If you take a look at signal intensities for what we got and what we missed, the signal intensities for what we got are something like 2.5 to 3-fold higher in terms of mean and median signal intensities than the things we missed. So again, if we just look at operons, it looks as if there's some sort of relationship between what we pick up and signal intensity on the Affymetrix arrays. Yes?
I'm still unclear on what you consider surprising about the observation. Are you suggesting that it's surprising that there's a general correlation between protein content and messenger RNA content?
Yes.
Which I would have to say cannot seriously be doubted. Or are you saying it's surprising that the analytical methods, mass spec analytical methods or 2D gel-electrolysis analytical methods, are biased for detection of high abundance materials, which I, again, would think would not seriously be doubted.
All right, so Richard, for you it's obvious that amount of protein is going to correlate with amount of messenger RNA globally. No, that I understand. That I understand. That's why I threw out everything called absent. Okay? That's clear. But the point is, I don't think that anyone has ever formulated the idea, and certainly for eukaryotic organisms, it's, you know, hotly disputed, that protein abundance and messenger RNA abundance are related. So, yeah, I'm happy to say trivial, but I don't want to do it too quickly, because one of the reasons for wanting to say trivial is it's well known that if you want to increase the amount of particular proteins, you often increase the amount of transcript. But we're talking about different transcripts for different things, and we're saying that basically we're not seeing any great effect of how frequently you might initiate translation of a given transcript. Might be buried in here. It's premature. I don't want to divert onto this too much because I have one last thing I really want to say.
Okay. So, but just following that up, I mean, are there a lot of genes in your first bin, let's say, where there's a ton of message where you don't see much proteins?
That's the question that was asked of me earlier, and I haven't looked at that. That's a very interesting question. I haven't looked at it that way. So I'm really glad I brought it up, because I need to look at it that way. Yeah.
But none of your friends among these gene products have jumped out at you, obviously.
I've looked at certain numbers of friends among these gene products, but I haven't done a very serious look at my friends among these gene products. One set of friends that I have looked at that might interest you, FTS genes, which come in very varying amounts and are essential under all growth conditions. We pick up the guys that are estimated to be at 100 copies per cell and some intermediate abundance, and we miss the guys at the low end. And similarly, okay, we miss the lac enzymes, and the athiarase call them marginal or absent. And so, yes, we know that we need 3 molecules per cell in order to get induction of the lac operon, but in some sense, you can consider those absent functionally for cells grown on glycerol. So, again, when you get down into baseline, okay, what do you want to call functionally present and absent? You're going to have a problem, which is why I wanted a high reliability list that keeps me above the muck. Yeah. I'm not showing you fold change here.
Yeah, but at some point, you need to know sort of the low.
Oh, the numbers, the largest numbers of protein molecules per cell in the smallest is going to run from 1 to 100,000. There are not many present at 100,000, but there are a few. Lipoprotein. Yeah?
Porins.
Yeah, porins. Yeah. Okay, now I want to leave this subject to get to say one more thing, but I'm happy to talk all week. Nothing. It's just a presence call. That's all they can do without other methods to try to allow them to quantitate. So there are a few studies now on being able to modify proteins in extracts and quantitate differences in protein levels between different preps. But they're relatively new, and we certainly haven't done that. Okay, I want to tell you one last thing. I'm going to skip structure, which was related to what Jim talked about, and I'm going to go on to my latest passion, because this is my new passion, and I think physicists are going to be interested in this. So I can summarize what I would have told you before, perhaps the most important part of it. It turns out that for Jim's proteins, the response regulators, which other people are also deeply interested in, which form aspartyl phosphate linkages, those linkages are often extremely labile. Their half-lives are seconds to minutes, depending on the process being regulated. And so it was very difficult to get structures of those things in their activated conformations. And it turns out that Dalai Yen, when he was a postdoc in my lab, a number of years ago, found that you could use beryllium fluoride to make an aspartyl phosphate mimic. You can do that with nucleotides as well. You're getting a mimic of an acid anhydride. And because those mimics are persistent, David Wemmer in the chemistry department at Berkeley could determine the structures of activated receiver domains, some activated response regulators, some of those things complexed with their targets. So it solved a universal problem. And it turns out it generalizes beyond that, because you can also get aspartyl phosphate mimics in enzymes that have aspartyl phosphate as catalytic intermediates. Those include certain phosphatases and so-called P-type ATPases, including the calcium ATPase. So this is a wonderful chemical trick for getting structures. So I want to come now to my last section, which is one on biological gas channels. We stumbled over those, which as far as I know have not been previously described, again in connection with our interest in nitrogen metabolism in E. coli. So we disrupted the AMTB gene of that organism, which was said to be an active transporter for the ion NH4+. And we found no growth defect at neutral pH, no matter how low we made the concentration of ammonium, meaning both species together. We could go down to 0.2 millimolar. We only found a growth defect when we finally thought to lower the pH. So you see a growth defect at low ammonium and low pH. not caused by low pH, because when you raise the ammonium concentration, that growth defect goes away. At that pH, the concentration of NH3, the gas, is down into the 50 nanomolar range. And we've done a variety of experiments that provide evidence that, in fact, AMT and the related proteins in yeast, neurospora, and other organisms, which are called MEP, are gas channels for NH3. In enteric bacteria, they are needed when you get down to the 50 nanomolar range. There are theoretical reasons to think that active transporters for the ion NH4+ do not exist. Now, I'm the only person in the world right now who's going to tell you that, but I am going to tell you that pretty categorically. It turns out that the AMT proteins have only one relative in protein sequence space. That's been observed. It's been known for a long time that the AMT proteins never changed their substrate specificity, despite the fact that, as I'll show you in a minute, they seem to be very ancient. And people puzzled over that. I think that is because they are gas channels. So the relative is the rhesus or Rh proteins, of which the human Rh blood group substance is best known. Based on cloning two of the human Rh proteins into a yeast mutant, Marini, Andre, and their colleagues concluded that Rh proteins were also active transporters for NH4+. Their evidence was self-contradictory, and we now have a lot of published evidence that the AMT proteins themselves are not active transporters for NH4+. So I got angry for various reasons, and I went to the library to learn something about Rh proteins. So I'll show you what I learned in just a minute, but it led me to speculate that the Rh proteins might be gas channels for carbon dioxide. And in a minute, I'm going to show you one experiment that provides indirect evidence for that speculation. It means that its substrate is a gas, not an ion. That's correct. I'm thinking of E. coli living in water. NH3 and CO2 go through membranes in an unmediated manner, and I think there are circumstances under which protein channels have to facilitate their movement. So what's interesting about them, they are both readily hydrated gases. I think that that hydration can, under some circumstances, prevent rapid enough movement in an unmediated manner, but it can also allow exchange of the water of hydration for contacts with channel residues that would give you specificity. That's how the potassium channel works. And that's, you know, this is rank speculation, but that's what I think is going on here. NH3 is a gas. It's an uncharged species.
Yes, it could not be NH3, but NH4OH, which goes through the channel.
It could be an...
You wouldn't be able to see the difference because it's basically NH2 plus water.
It could be, but I am told by some chemists that there is no such thing as NH4OH. This is going to get us into another area of physical chemistry, and I think physics, okay, where there is a lot that hasn't been properly explored. Okay? So, yes. Well, if you want to talk about gas and dissolved gas, you're really into an area where people seem to know nothing. I had this discussion with Chris Walsh recently. The point is, so I'm going to tell you that I've done a lot of physiological work on these channels. Let me tell you something interesting about them. I'm after a structure, and I'm after a structure with the substrate in the channel so that I can work that out. And the good news is that when you clone AMT proteins from hyperthermophiles, Aquafex aeolicus or Methanococcus unashii, into E. coli, they work. They complement the growth defect of the E. coli mutant. I think they're not active transporters. I think they're channels for a gas, or if you want to say something hydrated, I can't rule it out right now, okay? But we can come back to that.
Question, but if we're talking about single molecules, what do you do them to be gas?
Well, I think the point is that gases are things that don't interact well with other things or with themselves. And as I said, I think that ammonia and CO2 are unusual in that they are readily hydrated. They interact with water readily. So let me show you just a couple of other things, and then, you know, we can debate this. I mean, clearly there's a lot of work to be done here, but I think this is going to be fun and interesting. So first thing I learned about the Rh blood group substance, it's present at 100,000 copies per red cell. Its function has been unknown for over six decades. The only thing more abundant in the red cell membrane is the bicarbonate exchanger. This glycophorin is of mysterious function. It may be a chaperone. Those are present at 1 million copies per cell. So what that told me was that the function of Rh proteins could not be subtle. This was something that was right in the center of red cell function. The other thing you could learn in the library, and this was largely from, in the case of Rh, from work of a man named Chenghan Huang, who's a fine human geneticist at the Blood Center in New York City, you could learn things about the distribution of Rh. Let me start with the distribution of AMT, which was pretty well known. AMT appears to be of ancient origin because it's all over the bacterial and archaeal worlds, all over microbial eukarya, and all over higher plants. It goes into the invertebrates. For example, C. elegans has four AMT MET proteins. And then it disappears in the vertebrates, where it's notably absent in mammals. And again, people talk about ammonia toxicity, but I don't know what exactly is the basis for ammonia toxicity in these organisms. Rh has essentially the opposite distribution. It is nowhere in the bacterial or archaeal worlds. It is very rare in microbial eukarya. I'll come back to that. It's not found in higher plants. It comes up in the invertebrates, so C. elegans has two Rh proteins. And then in the vertebrates, it spreads and becomes quite prominent in mammals. If you look at organ distribution and tissue distribution in mammals, in humans, for example, you find these proteins in erythrocytes, and you also find them in a number of other organs, including the brain, the kidney, and you find them in epithelial cells of those tissues. So when I put those two things together, I decided that Rh, from my point of view, was likely to be a gas channel for CO2. So I think that the bacteria and archaea are too small to need those sorts of channels. Plants are getting CO2 directly out of the air. The rate of diffusion of CO2 in water is 10,000-fold slower than in air. And one of the microbial eukarya that has Rh proteins, the green algae. So the green algae need these channels, I believe, to get CO2 for photosynthesis under certain circumstances. The only other organisms that have them are Dictyostelium, the only other microbes. That's an interesting matter as well, but I'm not going to talk about that. They have homology. They are paralogs. Okay, and they are the only two homologs in that superfamily. Two. Yes?
And secrets would also indicate that it's a membrane protein?
Oh boy, are they membrane proteins. They are nasty, hard to handle membrane proteins, which is why one reason why so little is known about Rh proteins of humans. Extremely difficult to handle. Okay? So I'm going to show you the one or two experiments that we did. Oops, going backwards. And wrap it up. So we wanted to work on these things in green algae. We wanted a microbe that had both AMT and Rh proteins and that would control their expression directly in response to the environment. So this is my lab manager. That's Chlamydomonas reinhardii. You grow it in these nice flat bottles so you can control the light intensity, and of course you can control the gas mixture that you're giving it. So we simply asked what regulated expression of AMT and Rh. AMT, as in other organisms, is regulated by nitrogen. This is a northern blot showing you how expression of Rh is regulated. This is total RNA. When you grow bubbling with 3% CO2, you get blazing high levels of message. When you grow in air, you don't. When you shift up for 3 hours, that's sufficient. When you shift down for 3 hours, your message is gone. This is a standard control used in Chlamydomonas for the so-called carbon concentrating mechanism. What does this organism have to do to get enough CO2 when it's growing in air and the concentration is down 100-fold? Well, one of the things it does is to induce a variety of carbonic anhydrases. This is a periplasmic carbonic anhydrase known to be induced in air, and we use it as a control to see the opposite response. This is the small subunit of ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase and total RNA. You see the same thing at the protein level. You make RH only in high CO2, not in air. When you shift down, it doesn't go away as rapidly. When you shift up, it doesn't come up as rapidly. Same behavior for the periplasmic carbonic anhydrase. So it looks as if this protein is allowing Chlamydomonas to equilibrate CO2 when it's available at high concentration. It grows very well under those circumstances. So we think the hypothesis that RH proteins are gas channels for CO2 is viable, and we're in the process of trying to get Chlamydomonas mutants that lack the function of this RH1 protein. Turns out that's non-trivial because there's no targeted mutagenesis in that organism, which is why we didn't start by making mutants. It turns out that, as far as I'm concerned, movement of gases and living organisms is another project that may be of interest to physicists. And if this hypothesis is correct, human respiratory physiology, much of which is predicated on the assumption that CO2 movement into and out of erythrocytes is unmediated, is going to have to be modified. And I'll stop there. Yeah. I think because Chlamydomonas grows in water and plants are getting CO2 from the air, but I can't get beyond that. What's happening in terms of movement, in terms of internally, I can answer that. But the observation, that is the observation. Mm-hmm. And it is, by the way, well known in Dictyostelium that ammonia is a major regulator of Dictyostelium development, believed to be the gas, ammonia. And recently I read that they think there must be another gas that takes the pH in the opposite direction that's important. Dicty's got RH. I'm going to say I think that second gas is CO2. Great. Thank you. Super.